last night. A vision. I saw a world full of people. Everybody was dancing and screaming loud. They were just there to listen to the music. It was deep. It was underground. Let's turn the world into a dance floor.
Are you guys ready for a state of trance? Put your hands in the air, come on!
This is a State of Trance podcast.
What's up and welcome to a new State of Trance podcast. My name is Ruben Ronde and I'm joined by the one and only duo, Kio and Albert today. How are you doing?
Hello, Ruben.
Hi. We are well.
It's awesome to have you guys here. I've already took one of my vinyls with me. You signed it during the State of Trance broadcast. So thank you for that.
No problem.
This year you're celebrating 26 years or 25 years as a duo. And I want to go back to the very first beginning. Well, separately, because before you were a duo, you were doing stuff separately. And I want to know of both of you, why did you start making music? What sparked you that you're like, okay, I need to start making music?
Basically, I was a teenage boy and before I was a kid, I was playing with Lego. And then when you become teenage boy, you get a hobby. And my hobby was I was keen on starting making music.
Mm-hmm. Why? Why did you start making music? Oh. Because there's always a trigger, right?
I had an older brother and he brought all the 80s music to me. So I grew up with, you know, Pet Shop Boys and all this 80s stuff. But at this time, I was a school kid. I was young. And when I became a teenager, I was interested in synthesizers, drum machines. And I said to my parents, I want to have a synthesizer. And they said, you cannot play a piano. And I said, I want to have a synthesizer. That's my dream.
Which do you still have that synthesizer?
Yeah, I got it. And then luckily 1.5 years later in mid-December 1991, I had my first live show. It was at little Atari drum machine and computer at the underground techno party in Germany.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was at this time I was at school and everybody was listening to hip hop. They said, what are you listening
1991?
To?
1991, okay, yeah.
And 1993 I released my first vinyl and then I met Stevie. He went to the same school, but he was a little bit younger.
Yeah. I still am.
You're still at
he
home.
Still is. And I arranged
always four
for him,
years younger.
I arranged for him a MIDI interface and a synthesizer by former schoolmate of me. He did music, but he wanted to sell the MIDI interface, and then Stevie can tell the rest of
the
story.
Did you already make music before you met Rolf?
Yeah, but just for me, you know. I had a Commodore C64. I don't know if you remember this.
Yes.
A lot of people always only use it for gaming, but there was also a little synthesizer program.
Okay.
And there was also a drum computer program, but it didn't work together. So I did like overdubbing with the cassettes.
So you recorded with the cassette and then you recorded another part again.
Yeah, yeah. But this was just the very early beginning. I was always fascinating of synthesizers and drums. So if there was a live band somewhere, you always found me behind the drums or behind the keyboarder. So this was always my fascination. And then early also bought a keyboard, but I was really disappointed because there were no cool sounds on it, only organs, flutes and stuff like this. So then I also turned into synthesizers.
I remember my grandfather had the same thing. He had like one of these big, the church synths, I would say, but it was only whack sounds. It was But that's such a long time ago. And then you went to the same school and then Rolf was already performing live and then you met, how did you meet each other?
Actually, with a friend, I came to because it's not a big city we are living in. So I knew where he lived, but we didn't have contact before. And I had a demo with me, and Ralph liked it. And so then we said, let's do a live act together.
Okay,
And we produced four tracks. And during the production, we found out we really work well together. And also, the tracks were really cool and we wanted to release them.
So. And we had the advantage because back in the days, synthesizers were very expensive. So we merged our equipment Stevie first had...
It's by the C64 now.
No, no.
You had cassette tapes.
I had Atari, which was better back in the days.
That's right.
He had a Commodore 64. However, we had then more synthesizers. I even remember that we had then two mixers.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and we did just... We didn't plan to do Kaya and Albert. We just planned this live show, Kaya versus Albert, because I was known as Kaya and his name is Albert. So we said Kaya versus Albert. And then we had the nice tracks, which became our first EP. Mm-hmm. And we pressed it CDs, vinyls, in self-distribution. It was a local, even a little club hit and on radio. And then it started. We did live shows.
Yeah, also... All the DJs in our area started to play this, and so there was a high demand for the CDs. So we brought packs of CDs to all the record stores, and so
was that Let Me In?
Yeah.
Yes.
So it was your first release was 1996 together.
Yes. Yeah.
That's crazy. So you were that's the roots of Euphonic Records, basically already. That you were just instead of finding a label for your stuff, you were like, we'll just do it ourselves.
Yeah, there was a label before called Harmony Recordings, but. When we tried to make it more professional, we found out that there's already a label, Harmony Recordings.
It was a sub-label of BMG or something like the house label, so Harmony House Recordings. And this Harmony Recordings I did with a friend before, and then he didn't want to continue because he took over the company of his father. And I said to Stevie, let's do an own record label. And Stevie was we had different names, and then we decided that the Euphonic. And the Euphonic logo is still from this time. And maybe you remember the guy is Sonorous.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the designer. And he did this logo for us. And we are still in contact with him, but he is out of electronic music. He's doing now some indie band rock thing.
It's called Soyuz,
Soyuz.
Unbelievable. So he created the design of the label, and you kept the same all the time.
It was so great. The original version was a little bit different, but we do all things together, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody pretty democratic here. So, and then he brought in Ronsky. He knew Ronsky from DJ gigs. And so all started. The only guy I know before Stevie and all the other guys was Mirko de Govia, because when I was doing the first live shows in 1991, 1992, Mirko was also doing live shows with his computer, and we helped us out with equipment, producing wise, and so then we had a good team to start the label.
And this is 1996, 1997. This was before, I would say the big boom of trance music, which happened, of course, with Ferrocorcha, and it's 1999, 2000. So this was 4 years before that already.
Yeah, and I tell you something, I was with 15 years. In Berlin at clubs, you know, with friends, older friends who brought me in. Nobody cared about age. We were
different
doing
times.
A truck at the Love Parade where I was performing live. It was 1993. So, and at this time, the MFS label of Paul Van Dyk, where Paul Van Dyk was first featured, Cosmic Baby, some people remember.
Yeah.
And even Sven Fate was playing trance music. It was,
I guess that was before genres even existed. You just had dance music and that's it.
It was techno back in the days. Yeah. Nobody said trance.
No.
But especially MFS, they had this melodic approach. I would say in Germany, they are the first to do the trance. I would consider trance, you know. Mm-hmm.
But you guys discovered a lot of artists along the way as well for Euphonic. Like you already mentioned a couple of names. Mm. And even Dennis Shepard, for example.
Yeah. And also the first Ali and Fila record.
Ali that's
and
true.
Fila, I arranged for them in, was it 2002, 2003, a flat in Berlin and brought them to the first gig. Also, we did the Euphonic Night where we brought Above and Beyond the first time to Germany. And it's a long list.
Yeah,
I had to check before what we did, but it's so long time ago, you know.
It's such different times, and also I remember because I already mentioned I bought a lot of vinyl in the lockdown, so that's why I know Sonorous, of course, Glass Garden, but also you guys licensed in Above and Beyond tracks before they became big, also for Germany. So you had the rights.
Also, we did one Armin single, "Burned with Desire" on Euphonic, was on remixes, Kyle Albert remix. They were what other remix, Stevie, which other? Was the Ronsky Speed or Sonorous Remix?
I think.
But
for sure, a Kayan Albert remix.
For sure, a Kayan Albert remix. And like, we recently played it.
Really?
Yeah.
And, the classic show, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I would say it still sounds fresh.
Yeah, still this techie approach we still like. So, and yeah.
That is so funny, these stories. Because a few weeks ago, we had the Space Brothers here as well. And they also mentioned that they were the first ones to play an Above Beyond record ever in a club. So you guys also have similar experiences, but you wouldn't say it because you guys don't look like your grandfathers. But you were in business already in.
I mean, we started very early. I had the advantage that I meet guys who were local techno promoters, and I was just 15 and played them that I can make cool sounds on my synthesizer, and they said, "Hey, guy, do you wanna play a show?" And I said, "Yes." And I was the youngest in the crowd, and I had this, you know, if you find mentors or people who support you, and then this was the late.
We started early, but I also think music just keeps you young, keeps the mind young when you work with younger people, or when you work especially in music, so all the musicians look younger than they are. No, I think so.
Yeah, I think so too. Young at heart, right?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. But I just wonder, because like mentioned, you guys were there before dance music exploded. Like of course, Germany had, you mentioned it on air, in the May Days, you had Love Parade, you had all these massive festivals, Nature One, and then it became slowly became bigger in other countries as well. You saw that, you were part of the growth, and then suddenly it exploded worldwide. So what was your first experience that you were like, okay, this is actually going to be insane, it's going to be big?
I mean, at the beginning, we were only focused on Germany.
Because there's so much to do.
Yeah. There was a big techno culture, a big rave culture, all this fast stuff. So it started already in the beginning of the 90s or end of the 80s. And I think when we became more internationally recognized was, I think, with Velvet Morning.
Yeah.
But with the label, it was before. It was 2000. It was, we had the first UK charted with Mirko de Govia's Epic Monolith. Mm-hmm. And then Sonorous Glass Garden and all these things on Euphonic, which were big, you know. And sadly, Sonorous and also Mirko de Govia both decided not making music, trance or dance music anymore.
Sad.
But they have, Mirko, for example, has a job as IT, then, you know, privately had not luck, and he decided, no, I want to go forward.
Do you think it's also a matter of, this is going to sound weird, but I always wonder, because these guys were used to selling thousands of records, like vinyls, like they would sell tons. And then suddenly, when everything just crumbled down with the vinyl sales, an income of a track is not the same anymore. Do you think that matters in decisions of these guys not making music anymore?
I think probably. I mean, for us, it was when the sales went down, the gigs went up. So we made at some point much more money with gigs than with the label. But some people they don't like to travel, or they.
This was the case with Mirko. Mirko had the charted, he got offers to play in Ibiza, shows in Mexico, and we said, "Hey, Mirko, we can prepare everything. Just do it." And he said, "No, I don't want to travel. I don't want to do it." And Sonora's the same. He after Glasgow, he played one time in the US, and he came back and he said, "I don't want to travel so long." That's true. That's a personal decision, you know?
Yeah, I can understand it, I guess.
And
then the balance is gone, because if you don't want to travel for your shows, your income is not going to be the same as before. Yeah. Because you won't sell 25,000 copies of a track anymore. Mm.
But the industry changed so much during this. I think the music industry was one of the industries who suffered first of... Let's call it suffered first for all the digitalization. Yeah. So all these illegal downloads. I mean, right now it's getting better with the streams and everything, but there was a time that you didn't sell something, but everyone knew your tracks.
Yeah. Mm. Like, hey, wait a minute. Why are these singing along and no one bought these tracks? Yeah. What's going on? Yeah. Napster, Kazaa, LimeWire.
I mean, this helped for the gigs, of course, but not when you're only a musician, it doesn't help.
Mm. And you also mentioned it, Velvet Morning was the first tune that was being recognized internationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you still remember the moment that you were creating it or that it blew up?
Basically, can I tell the story?
Oh, yeah, do it.
Basically, it was the third single we did in Germany with Warner Music. The first one was Outside, which was not planned to be a major single or whatever. We did Outside.
Yeah, this was actually the track where I did sing for the first time.
Yeah. So, this was one of the vinyls I bought during lockdown as well. Yeah.
So it was meant to look for another singer, but...
And I said, Stevie, you have a wonderful voice.
I said, fuck off.
So this was 2001, produced in 2000. This was the same time like Glasgow, but you know, majors took months to release a track. Then we had Save Me and then Velvet Morning. And Velvet Morning had this Mirko de Govia remix, because original Velvet Morning was a girl-boy collab.
Yeah.
The singer of Fragma, Damé.
Okay, yeah.
And Mirko didn't use the vocals. And then we were in contact with Anjuna and they said, we really want to release the Mirko remix and not the original, the other versions. And then Pavo, was it a Super 8? And Pavo and Super 8 remix was on the flip side of the Anjuna release. And then with Velvet Morning, we had a good run.
But it was the Mirko remix, which everyone played outside.
Mm.
So Mirko had a really magic touch on it. Mm. Because he also had the vocals, a different approach to the vocals because different timing, but it worked really well. Mm. So yeah.
So when you heard it first, you were like, wait a minute, this is not correct. This is not how it should
I was
be.
Starting to say, you need to put the vocals on the right place. But no, it's cool like this. And then he was right.
Unbelievable. Sometimes it just happened like that. Those were also different times, I guess, that you would release something in euphonic and then for the UK Anjuna would pick it up and the other way around.
Yeah.
Now it's just a global thing, I guess.
Yeah, but with the digital global releases only makes sense. I mean, some labels do it, majors of course do it to promote it in special markets. But for us nowadays, it only makes sense to release a track worldwide on Anjuna or worldwide on euphonic. And basically we don't really release on other labels these days.
But we still have a strong relationship with Anjuna. So from time to time, we're still releasing tracks on Anjuna.
How do you decide, for example, which track will be released on Anjuna and which one is going to be on your own label?
We send them tracks and every track we send, they sign.
That's easy.
but basically, we are so long in the business, we don't send random demos.
No, when you know exactly this.
When we send a track out, we already tested it. Sometimes a demo is 2 years, 3 years old, and it has 15 stages, you know, and
I think behind every track which comes out are at least 10 or 20 demos, which are not good.
Yeah,
we are honest. So when we have tracks which are not good, then we don't release it.
That's smart. That's why when you play Pigments for the first time on the show, I saw that you played version 10.
But this was the final version.
This is the final version. This is a fast one, to be honest. Version 10 is not so bad. This year, you're celebrating 25 years as a duo. It is 26 already, but who's counting, right?
Mm, yeah.
What I would like to know, because there's producers listening to this podcast as well, is how is it possible that after 25 years, you're not killing each other yet?
Basically, we had a time where we both didn't like much, especially when we were hardcore traveling.
Yeah.
Imagine it was like you come back from the US, 3 days at home, and then you go 2 weeks Australia, and then 2 weeks seeing Stevie, and Stevie has had to see me. Yeah, but it's, you know, it's 25 years. It's a long time, longer than some relationship.
100%.
Last,
you know? Yeah.
But I also think when we started traveling so heavy, we already knew for 10 years or so. So we knew how to deal with each other. So of course, sometimes we are arguing, but always we come back.
What is the last argument that you had?
I don't know.
Or disagreement?
I don't have so much.
Basically, we are both not emotional driven. We are both kind of, you know.
We have, of course, discussion, but nothing not a big difference. Only small things on decisions sometimes. But
I think that when bands break or some relation, then one of the person is a diva. And yeah. I think we are not no divas, I would say. No. Maybe Stevie a little bit.
Yeah, but Stevie is a singer, so yes. Singers are divas.
I have to be a diva.
Now, I just wonder, because 25 years, it's like a long relation. Most marriages don't even survive 25 years. So just that's why I wonder, like, it's almost impossible. But you never had a big fight or anything in... Well, maybe...
Not a big fight.
No, okay. No. Well, that's, I guess, what you said. Is so that it helped at your
even
friends.
Even about
before.
Taste. I know when Stevie really don't like things or don't like, then...
And how does he show?
I just say it.
Yeah. Is that the most important thing? That just being honest? Yeah. Sometimes brutally honest. That you have to.
But it's the same with Ralph. He also, when I do some vocals and he said, that sounds shit. Of course it hurts.
No, this comes from the heart.
but at the end, it's always good to have an objective position from each other.
I think this is a little advantage of being a band or a duo. Yeah. When you're a single artist, you do your own stuff and you don't really have a feedback. Ask your brother, he said, shit, good. Your girlfriend, I don't care. Yeah. And we are sitting in the same boat. So when I think there should be something different or so, I can say it to Stevie and he understands it. Mm-hmm. We are on the same, we're sitting in the same boat.
Mm. And you have the same musical taste as well?
Mm, I would
almost.
Say so.
Almost, yeah.
That's interesting. And when you make music, you always sit together or you each have your own role? Like how do you normally work? Like
we don't sit together so much anymore because we both have kids, families, and... Even we are very effective in, we don't, as I mentioned before, we don't do video sets or just
focus on music.
Yeah, we focus on music on Karen Albert and bring in the ideas and,
How do you do that with time-wise? Because you mentioned you have a family, you're traveling again tons after COVID. So that's really good for you guys. And you make music and you run the label. How do you juggle your time around?
I mean, we don't release so much as a label. So on Euphonic, we have two releases a month and Visions once. Mm-hmm. And our schedule is tight.
But it works somehow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It doesn't really feel like work because it's just doing what you like, it feels like doing a hobby.
Even after all these years, it's still nice. Oh, awesome. And then and somehow that you discover that you're a good singer, that's a bit of a plus, I guess.
It makes it much easier because when you have an idea, you can even at night go to the studio, record this, and you don't have to explain someone, sing a little bit more like that or put a little bit more emotion into this. Mm. So when you do it by yourself, it's faster.
Rolfi, do you also write some lyrics now and then for the...
Basically, there were one single I was giving my vocals, but I'm not keen on, singing. Because Stevie is the brand. He has the timbre, he's the voice, that's it.
You can hear it straight away. It's when you hear Stevie's voice. Mm. You know, this is a Cajun Albert track. Did you ever consider to record some vocals for other people as well?
Do you mean... he did collabs like, but then it always was a collab, as a Cajun Albert collab with someone else. For example, we did it with Paul Van Dyk.
Yeah.
Or with Alien Fila. It was always... From their request, we don't really look for doing collabs, so not actively.
No.
It also makes no sense for us normally.
And, it doesn't make sense. And right now we have so much material, so many compositions laying around, which possibly get released in the next 2 years.
Is that also one of the reasons why you started Hello Machines? Did you have so much material, or was it just the sound?
Hello Machines was a tester at the time, but maybe Stevie can say it better.
Yeah, this was a time then you had the feeling to try something new, without having borders in your mind. Because when you do a Karen Albert track, you always...
You have to stick to a certain dance floor sound.
Yeah, and with Hello Machines, nobody knew at the beginning.
We wanted to test new things out.
I think... Still now, not many people to know.
No, we haven't really promoted it.
Yeah.
Overall, we both hate social media. We don't want to bring our families, our private homes, whatever, into the internet. We just do our music. We do our Euphonic Sessions podcast. We do the shows and that's it.
Yeah.
So we, and this is possibly where we are very similar. We are, you know, we are having our Karen Albert thing. This will last as long as it lasts. But
in the meantime, you have a normal life as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a healthy balance.
This is really important for us.
I think so too. Uh-huh. Especially if you want to keep on going for such a long time, then you need to have, you need to be able to switch off your artist side as well.
Yeah. Mm.
And get your family out. Already there almost already. I just have a couple of questions from some fans, starting with Ellen Talker. She wants to know, how do you feel about playing the big stages for the first time? You mentioned it already on State of Trance in the episode that you played the big stage for the first time.
Yeah, it was trance energy, was breathtaking. We came there in and didn't expect that it's so big.
It was a
And Mayday for the first time.
Especially because in Germany, Mayday is like a big brand, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you are a kid, I always said, one time I want to play on the Mayday. And finally it worked out and it was like a nice feeling for yourself. Not even about the party, but just because you achieved it, you know. Yeah. This was a great feeling.
But to be very honest, when you play on a big festival, EDC or Electric Zoo or whatever, you don't really have contact to the eyes of the people.
Yeah,
and I love to play in a crowd where I see the people smiling, singing, dancing. I mean, it's nice to play the big festivals for the, you know, profile, whatever. But I love to have shows
more private
with contact to the crowd.
Same,
and on huge events, for example, Trans Energy, you don't see the crowd. On EDC, you don't see the crowd.
You have lights on your eyes.
You see...
A lot of people.
A lot of people, but it's no interaction. And I really like and to be in interaction or see the people. Not the whole crowd, but that you see the faces singing,
you can feel their energy.
Laughing. Yeah. That's my personal opinion.
No, I think that's a good one because I agree on a certain extent as well. Because when I played my Open to Close a few weeks ago, it was a small crowd in a small venue, but you could see everyone. So you could see exactly what they were feeling or something. And when you play a big stage, I still love it though, because it's such a rush.
Yeah.
Mm. You just see ants, basically.
Yeah. And for example, when we test new tracks, the people don't know. When you see in the faces of the people, you know if the track has potential or not. And therefore we test a lot.
No. And then you decide that Pigments 10 becomes Pigments 11, basically.
Yeah, sometimes at the show, you hear something and you think...
Also with the arrangement. Sometimes in the studio, you think, this is a nice arrangement. Mm. But when you play it live, it doesn't really work.
Mm. Yeah.
So we have always a lot of versions during testing. So at least 5, 6, 7... Or 10.
This is what we really missed when making new tracks and couldn't play them out via while the COVID time.
Yeah.
You know?
Because you didn't know if they would work on a dance floor or not. Next question. Sandra Daniel Albers. She wants to know, when are you going to release some new music on vinyl?
To be honest, nothing planned.
Nothing planned.
Nothing planned. Okay, that's easy. Transcyclopedia wants to know, currywurst or schnitzel?
Schnitzel.
Nothing for me, really.
No? Okay. Well, you go for schnitzel.
Yeah.
And the last one that I have for you guys is from Eddie Tape Exhale. What is your favorite trance track ever?
Oh, this first, rough. Hard question. A track which touched me when I was very young was Fallen Angel by Paul van Dyk.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1994, before I met Stevie, because it was, you know, so...
revolutionary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there are so many, it's unfair to name here because there were so many big tunes. For example, Armin's Burned with Desire was a huge track, original on the album, just as this chill out version.
Mm-hmm.
It was a cool track, but yeah, it's hard to pick.
What about you, Stevie?
It's probably...
You can't say For an Angel.
It's probably... When I started, I really liked Paul van Dyk. The Green Valley EP really influenced me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also liked a guy called Mike van Dyk, was also on MFS. Mm-hmm. I also really liked the way he produces.
Yeah, Mike van Dyk was... do you know Mike van Dyk?
I know by name, yeah.
He was also the guy who produced the Schöneberg by Marmion together with Marcos Lopez. And he is underrated. He was really cool in the first years, had his own sound, own bass lines.
Different times. Mike van Dyk. Well, if you haven't heard of Mike van Dyk, check it out, please. Yeah. Stevie
said. And it's his real name. His real name is Michael van den Nieuwendijk.
But why van Dyk then? Because of Paul van Dyk? Or?
To make it shorter.
Yeah,
but it's spelled different. Not
it's different. It's a D-I-J-K. Nieuwendijk.
Ah, okay, like that. Okay, okay, I understand.
So his father is Dutch also.
There's always a little bit of Dutch in there. Always. I have to claim it. Thank you guys for answering these questions. Massive congratulations once again. 25 years as a duo. The end of the year, you're going to have your album. In the meantime, we're going to look out for all these EPs with amazing remixes.
Yeah, and if you want to see us live, go to karnalbert.com or best, our socials, Facebook or so.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Next
time on the podcast, we're going to have Ali and Fila. If you have any questions for them, leave them down here in the comment section or send a message on Instagram. See you then. Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in. To check full episodes of A State of Trance for free, simply visit armandradio.com. A State of Trance returns next week.